This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lefebvre, your guest host tonight on the People Speak Radio. At the People Speak, we believe that the voices and actions of all people are needed to make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak Radio on bbsradio.com, live every Tuesday night from 9 to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Time. You can log into our website, thepeoplespeakradio.com, to join us live, listen to archives of previous shows, or join us in our live chat room on PalTalk. You can listen by phone. Dial 760-569-7676, enter access code 192919#, when prompted, or on your computer or smartphone, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to Station 2, and click the Listen icon. The People Speak invites audience participation. If you have questions or comments for our guest or topic during the show, please call toll-free in the USA and Canada, 1-888-429-5471. Tonight, my guest is Cindy Sheehan, well-known peace activist and currently running for the governor of California as the candidate for the Peace and Freedom Party. Good evening, Cindy. How are you tonight?
Good evening. Hello. I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, we're doing well here. I like, as I said, to get right into the show. Of course, your activities in the peace movement have been well-documented over the years, but your run for the governor of California is relatively new. So if we could start there, would you tell us how you decided, how you came to that decision?
Well, I have run for office in the past. In 2008, I ran against Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco as an independent, and I came in second and got almost 50,000 votes. And then last year, I ran for vice president on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket, and Roseanne Barr was the presidential candidate. And I am a member of the Peace and Freedom Party because of Prop 14, the top two primary. We are losing our status as a party if we, as a recognized party by the Secretary of State of the state of California, if we don't register something like 30 or 40,000 more people by the end of 2014. So part of my run is to promote our party and third party politics in general, and to oppose that idea of the top two primary that favors the two parties of war and parties of capital, the Democrats and Republicans. But part of it is to really rally my fellow Californians to co-create a better state. I was born and raised here. I've lived in a state that cared about education, that cared about families, that cared about the people, and I want to get back to that state for my surviving children and grandchildren. And we have to challenge the status quo as often as we can. Sometimes it's you know, with Occupy movement, sometimes it's with protest or writing or doing our independent media, and sometimes it's with challenging the system electorally like this. So I think that this is a urgent need to make our state better and to challenge the politics of the 1%.
Okay, now I did some background today of for my guests who aren't familiar with the Peace and Freedom Party, I'd like you to fill us in on their platform, and I'll preface it with this. There's a lot of libertarian positions, and my observation was it seemed to be the Libertarian Party with a heart.
Well, actually, we're a socialist party, which is the opposite of the libertarians. But it was founded in, I think, 1966 or 1967, and it was founded by the left anti-war movement and the anti-war movement on the right, which would have been mostly libertarians, or the genesis of of the LP in the United States. So our positions are mostly pro-worker, economic equality, pro-environment, feminist, and we're definitely 100% socialist.
Yeah, I've gathered that it was definitely socialist-leaning, where it crossed lines with the libertarian, where positions on the drug enforcement, the war on drugs, the need to draw our military back to our own shores as a defensive military and not a war of aggression or army of aggression worldwide.
Right. Well, that's also a very socialist positions, and anti-war libertarians and anti-war people of every political party, I think, have a lot in common.
Now, how's your run for governor going? As you said, you needed to gain 40,000 more people signed up by the end of 2014, but I also know it takes a considerable fundraising, especially in a state the size of California.
Right. Well, and Governor Brown has already raised $10 million for his reelection bid, and trust me, we've raised far less than that so far, but we just started. We just filed the paperwork about 2 months ago, maybe 6 weeks ago. But we're just getting started. We have the first thing we have to do is beginning at the end of December, and that's to start collecting signatures to get me on the ballot, and we're going to need 10,000 signatures. So if people want to help us in any way, the website for my campaign is Cindy2014.org. So people can go and get more information about the campaign, sign up to volunteer, donate, or whatever. But we're just barely now getting all these pieces put together for the signature gathering drive. That'll be the probably most important thing that's coming up.
Now, just 10 years ago, Cindy, you were a mom with a son in the military. You weren't yet active. Am I correct?
Right. It was my son was killed 9 years ago in April. So I'm still mom. I have 3 surviving children and 4 grandchildren now. But I was not an activist, even though I cared about the issues. I just didn't know how to express myself that way. And so, now since my son was killed, I have become a peace and social justice activist.
Now, I first became aware of you when you set up Camp Casey outside George Bush Jr.'s ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Would you care to walk us through your evolution from when you decided you needed to speak to the present?
Well, I decided I needed to speak. I wish I knew. I wanted to speak before Casey was killed. I didn't know there were protests anywhere till after they already happened. And Casey was against the wars. He was against George Bush. You know, there was no talk about we had to remain silent to support the troops at all, nothing like that. I just wasn't plugged into the whole activist pipeline. I never even heard about the protests or anything. But probably about 2 weeks after he was killed was when I made a conscious decision to start to investigate and try to find out ways that I could get Casey's story told, get our family's story told, and to confront the lies that killed Casey. And the very first time I spoke publicly was on July 4th of the same year he was killed, so exactly 3 months after he was killed. I was at a Unitarian Universalist church in Berkeley, and they were having a program with family members whose children had been killed in the war. And so I attended it and started speaking. And then I founded an organization called Gold Star Families for Peace. And that was comprised of people who have lost loved ones in war. And then about 18 months after, 16 months after Casey was killed, I heard George Bush say that the families of the loved ones can rest assured that their loved ones died. I mean, of the fallen could rest assured that their loved ones died for a noble cause, and nobody asked them what noble cause they died for. So I decided to go to Crawford, and within 3 days, I was marching down Prairie Chapel Road. We were stopped by the police, and George Bush refused to meet with me, so we set up camp. And that was when I was mostly against George Bush and against the Iraq War, but now I've evolved to be against all wars, against the system, against the military-industrial complex, against empire. And, you know, I've come to realize that the Democrats are just part of the problem. They're not apart from it. They are part of it. So I left the Democratic Party in 2007 and have been speaking out about peace and social justice since my son was killed.
Now, when you took those first steps and that first speech, did you ever envision you would be doing what you're doing now?
No, as a matter of fact, I thought that everything would be satisfactorily concluded by now. And I thought that if I poured my whole heart and everything I had into this movement, that it would be, my goals would have been realized by now. And of course, now I know that what's happening just didn't start with George Bush. It has been pretty much ever since we've been founded as a country. These problems are just growing and growing and growing. And I know people who have been active. In fact, I know some men who were draft resistors from World War II. That's how long they've been in the movement. So now I know that it's something that really is not really a movement, but a lifestyle. Once you start confronting the empire, it's something that is a lifelong situation you find yourself in.
Okay, now, you're totally opposed to war now. I had an alert, a question from an audience member that they didn't want to call in was, why did your son join the military?
Well, that's something I've talked about a lot over these past 9 years. There's no draft in the United States, but there's a situation where, and it's getting worse and worse and worse, where, you know, kids can't afford, young people can't afford to go to school. They can't afford the tuition and the fees and the books, and because they can't find jobs, and all the jobs that are out there are low paying and very menial. There's no good, jobs that pay a living wage with good benefits. When I got out of high school, I got a great job. I didn't even go to college. I just walked into a great job with great benefits and retirement. That doesn't happen anymore. And so Casey was in college, and he got preyed upon by a recruiter who promised him his college education. He promised him job training. He promised him that he would be able to take classes while he was in the military. And all of those promises were broken to my son. And so that's why a lot of people in the working and poor classes join the military. They can't find a job, and they can't afford to finish their college education. And as the budgets are, as money are taken away from our colleges and our universities, the student is forced to pay more and more. And they're reducing class sizes, so our kids can't even get the classes they need to graduate anymore. So a lot of our young people, especially in the poor and working classes, are being funneled into the military.
Well, that's something I understand. I have a son-in-law who was he joined in 96, same right out of high school. He didn't even go to college. And again, and I like that term, preyed on by recruiters.
Mm-hmm.
I knew
they're
a man.
Predators, and they lie. They're worse than used car salesmen. They still say anything to get our young people to sign on the dotted line. And what we didn't know then and what I know now is that contract is only binding on the recruit. It's not binding on the government. And one-sided unilateral contracts are most of the time illegal.
Okay, now, because as I said, my son-in-law joined for similar reasons. Fortunately, he came back, but not the same. He'll never be the same.
Right.
He went into combat off the books. I love how the military can send them in off the books, and made the number one mistake in combat. He looked the man in the eye before he pulled the trigger. But he came home. He said, decided it was a choice between this man's sons or his. But your son didn't come home.
Well, he did. His body, his shell came home. And that's, like you said, your son-in-law didn't come home the same. And I think that almost 100% of our young people die over there. You know, they die, their souls die, their hearts die, they get wounded terribly, or emotionally, physically, or psychologically destroyed. That's what war does.
And as I'm familiar with, and one of the things is one of our current issues that the VA only admitted to a few years ago was the high number of suicides among veterans.
Right.
And now it's coming out that we're losing more active duty military to suicide than we are to combat.
Right.
So your son didn't come home, but something else I saw in there is your son died in 2004. Have you ever paid your taxes for that year?
I haven't paid my taxes since my son was killed.
And what would your reason for not paying your taxes be?
Well, because I don't want to fund the things that my government does. That's why. And I should never have funded. I actually subsidized my own son's murder by paying my taxes. And unless this empire changes dramatically, I won't pay my taxes. I don't support things I don't agree with. And I don't agree with what our government does.
Well, I'm with you on that. So has the IRS, now you're a political candidate for the governorship in literally our most populous state, but you haven't been paying your taxes. Has the IRS interfered with your ability to run?
No, not at all. I have run for office twice. Like I said, this is my third run for a political office since my son was killed, and that doesn't even become an issue at all. I have been pursued by the IRS in 2012. I think was it? Yeah. 2000 and I think it was last year. The IRS subpoenaed me and I went to court, and the judge who heard, well, the magistrate who heard the, arguments of the government that wanted him to force me to comply with the IRS, the judge refused to do that. He said my response to what happened to my family was civilized, and what happened to my family was uncivilized. So, you know, the IRS will still try to collect, but they don't have anything. And then they spent like months trying to, find my hidden assets that I don't have. And so I think they realized that I don't have any assets because I try to live very simply. And since the magistrate refused their request that I comply with them, the IRS what did they do? They revoked the subpoena, so I'm not on the hook with them anymore.
Well, I don't think they want that getting out to others who might duplicate your actions. Now,
well, there's a lot of people who are war tax resistors, and they've been war tax resistors for decades. As a matter of fact, I'm going to Vermont this weekend to speak at the New England War Tax Resisters regional conference. And I think it was in May I spoke at the National Conference for War Tax Resisters. And if people want more information about how they can do that, there's the National War Tax Resisters Coordinating Committee. So it's the NWTRCC.org.
Okay. Now, of course, there's been many well-known peace activists in this organization. Two others that are well-known that resist paying taxes would be Cynthia McKinney and Jesse Ventura. Have you worked with them at all?
I did not know that they were tax resistors. And Cynthia McKinney I've worked with very closely, yes. Jesse Ventura, I just know him through my radio show. He was on my show one time. But I did not know that they were tax resistors.
Well, a good many of us feel that our government is misspending our money, so why should we be handing it over?
That's what I agree with. I think if you know, 100 million people decided to go that route, that would make a profound difference in policy.
Yeah, to not passively accept that their demands. And one of the quotes I found on one of your sites was that when they give you back your son, then you will pay your taxes.
Right, and I don't really, it's not about my son because I can't bring him back. It's about the people who are in harm's way now. I said that when I was like, I was literally ambushed in a restaurant by a news crew that were the ones that informed me that the government had filed this lawsuit against me. I didn't even know about it. And so I had been ambushed and I said that quote. And so it's about stopping future crimes of the government. And it's about not subsidizing what my government stands for.
Okay. Now, the other thing that I found is that how many times have you been arrested now?
I lost count, but I think it's somewhere around 20, plus or minus.
One of the things I've noticed about the various organizations that claim to stand up about against the government is when the arrests start, they back down.
Right. There's very few organizations that are committed to civil resistance.
And when you consider it, then the fact that you've been arrested so many times, there's other people in our history who were opposed to war and were trying to make great changes. And I'm going to throw you right up there with one of the greatest would be Martin Luther King.
Yes, he was committed to civil resistance, as was Gandhi was committed to civil resistance. And there's another one who was arrested because he spoke out against World War I, and that's Eugene B. Debs. And he spent a year in jail, I think, or in prison on sedition because he was speaking out against the war. So I it has to be, again, a few people resisting their taxes is an irritant, but if 100 million did it, and it's a form of civil resistance, is being a war tax resister, it would have a profound effect. If we had 10,000 people in Washington, D.C., who were willing to do this nonviolent civil resistance, we could have a profound effect, but it's just so few people.
Now, the first name in American history that I'm aware of, and I'm sure there were others before, but the most famous war tax resister was, in fact, Henry David Thoreau. How do you feel about being in such elevated company?
Well, I've always been an admirer of Thoreau. Ever since I was in college, I studied on Walden's Pond and on civil disobedience. And I tried to convince my husband at the time that we should sell everything and move out to the woods. I so admired. Not only did Henry David Thoreau have some good philosophy, he had the integrity to live the way he wrote, the way he spoke. And so I've always tried to do that. And he's definitely one of my role models. Also, I'm glad you brought him up because you brought up Martin Luther King Jr. and I brought up Gandhi, and they were followers of Henry David Thoreau. Henry David Thoreau inspired them also.
I think a good many of us that came through the Vietnam generation, you and I are very close in age, and a lot of us were aware of Thoreau because his name was a big part of even the Vietnam anti-war movement. Now, we're shortly going to get into the second half of the show here and open up to more audience questions. What is the one thing you most want people to hear in your message?
That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure that I can narrow it down, but you know, the thing I think that's most missing in the United States today is people thinking that they can make a difference. They think that the problems are so huge, and the problems are huge. I can't deny that the problems are so huge. And the venues we have to get our voices heard are so small that we can't really make a difference. And I think I am living proof that one person can make a difference, because I was one person. And I decided on Wednesday, August 3rd, to go to George Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. I was there August 6th. The first night, I had 6 other people spending the night with me. By the end of the summer, we had, you know, like 17 or 18,000 people come to Crawford, Texas, and tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people around the world, you know, in solidarity with us, doing, you know, Camp Casey's and support rallies and all of these other kinds of things. So I think I want people to know that you shouldn't sit around waiting for somebody else to make a difference. That you're the person that I don't know who said it, we're the ones we've been waiting for. You're the person that you're waiting for to make a difference, and that you can make a difference. You just have to break that myth that one person can't make a difference. It doesn't mean you're going to make a difference in the lives of millions of people. If you just make a difference in the lives of one person, or your family, or your neighborhood, or your community, that's what we need to do.
Okay, now, Cindy, we're about halfway through the show, or a little more then. We're going to take a short break here. I want to remind the listeners, this is the People Speak broadcasting live on BBS.com Internet Radio. We'll be back shortly.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please give to the World Food Program.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to vbsradio.com.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Welcome back to The People Speak, live on bbsradio.com, internet radio. Again, I'm Jeanette Lefebvre with our guest Cindy Sheehan, candidate for Governor of California. During this portion of the show, you can call in questions and comments for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada, 1-888-429-5471. Now, Cindy, we were talking during the break about your final remarks and the quote, if not me, who, if not now, when. We have no idea who's made the quote, and we've both heard it.
Right.
Do you want to follow up on that, or do you want to move along on to your candidacy for the governor?
I just think that if you don't try, you can't make a difference. And if you try, you will make a difference. That's guaranteed. And so I encourage everybody to look around them, find an issue that they care about that's outside of their own circle of concern, and become concerned about that and try to alleviate suffering. And if you try, you will. There's just like no question about it.
Okay, now, when it comes to running for governor, of course, you know, you're probably what they would call the outside candidate. Do you have any indication of how well you might poll against Governor Brown?
No, there's no polling or anything. Like I said, when I ran in San Francisco against Nancy Pelosi, we were doing our own polls and commissioning polls. And it was showing that I was only going to get about 9%, and I ended up getting 17%. So I think that after the signature drive and when we know who's going to be on the ballots, that might become more of an issue. And of course, I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican in California. We have that terrible top two primary law that favors the people with the most money, which are the Democrats and the Republicans. So if we had that law in 2008, I would have come in second, and I would have been in the general election against Nancy Pelosi. So I think then maybe I would have had more of a chance to influence the dialogue, influence the policies. So, you know, there is a chance, and it might even be a good chance, that I could come in second in June and then go on to the November primaries. So I'm not ruling that out at all, since I already came in second once against a woman who has all the money in the world. She and her own family, they have tens of millions of dollars. And she outraised me by 300 or 400% when I ran against her. And it's another thing is I raised a good amount of money when I ran against her. We raised almost $700,000, and we spent every penny plus in the district on this campaign. And so once the campaign gets rolling and snowballing, we do have also a chance to, I think, raise enough money to make a difference.
Okay, now I want to repeat for my listeners that you are running on the Peace and Freedom Party, which, in fact, formed in 1966 from what you said earlier. Why do you think so few people are familiar with your party?
You know, I don't know. I can't really say that. But in this country, not just the state of California, the political process and paradigm are owned by the Democrats and the Republicans. Third parties are demonized, shoved aside. We're refused entrance into debates. The media refuses to cover third party or independent candidates. And so, you know, the Peace and Freedom Party came out strong because it was against the war in Vietnam and it attracted a lot of people historically. But, you know, everything works against a third party or independent. So we're trying to raise our profile with this candidacy.
Now, in the last presidential campaign, they had third party debates off to the side. Were you a part of those debates?
Well, I was not, you know, because I was just the vice presidential candidate. But Roseanne Barr, my running mate, was shut out of those debates for some reason, and I can't even speculate why.
And one of the things that, because I've voted, the first time I ever voted for president, I voted for a third party. I voted for a man named Barry Commoner that nobody's ever heard of.
No, I've never.
But one of the things that happened during the last, because we all know that in 1993, after Ross Perot did so well, the Democrats and Republicans colluded to shut every other party out of those debates. And one of the things I found very disturbing in the last election was when Jill Stein was arrested trying to enter the debates.
Right.
I feel that's rather un-American to arrest presidential candidates.
Well, and it also happened here in 2010 in California. The Green Party gubernatorial candidate, Laura Wells, was arrested in 2010 before Jill was, trying to get into the... In fact, she had a ticket. Somebody gave her a ticket to get into the debate, and they dragged her out of it. And so I don't know if it's un-American. That might be American. You know, that might not be what we think the United States stands for, but the United States is certainly proving it stands for oppression. It stands for spying on people. It stands for shutting down dissent. It stands for silencing voices of opposition. So, you know, maybe that is the way America works now.
Okay, now I'm starting to get questions in from my audience. From Pep in Australia, she wants to know, Cindy, how does your family deal with your status and activities as an international peace activist?
They deal, you know, really well with it. My children are very supportive of what I do. And I recently was gone for 3 months on a bike ride across the United States called Tour to Peace. I left on April 4th, the day my son was killed, and got to Washington, D.C. on July 3rd. And that was really, really hard because my grandchildren are all 5 and under. And so we missed each other a lot, and they can't really understand why I'm gone and at that time why I was gone so long. And they're getting a little bit older, though, that I can talk to them on the phone and by Skype and things like that. So the only thing that is hard is to be away from the family. But they know what I'm doing, they know why I'm doing it, and they support that. And they support me in many ways. You know, they give me... you know, they give me really good moral support, and I can talk to them about, you know, personal things that happen that I can't talk to other people about, and they're able to give me support that way too. So, and then we're all very close. We have a very close family, and like my oldest grandson just started kindergarten in August, and there was probably about 12 people there from our family taking him to school that first day. So, I couldn't do it without the support of my family, and they support me very well.
Okay, now the next question comes from Nicole in Tennessee. How do you feel about the USA giving billions of dollars in armament and weapons to Israel every year?
I am totally against that. I think that Israel and our support of Israel, the apartheid state of Israel, is one of the biggest reasons for the destabilization of the Middle East and why we're getting into these wars one after the other. And you just have to look at the Project for a New American Century or Clean Break for Israel to see that this has been the plan of the neoconservatives for a long, long time now, probably almost two decades. And so we have so many problems here in the United States. We spend trillions on war. We give billions to Israel when they're cutting back education and social services here in the United States. So I'm against foreign aid, really, military aid. I think that it should be situational and based on needs and for emergencies, not, you know, giving our money, your money, your tax money, whoever pays their taxes, to a different state who causes destabilization and is occupying and strangling Palestine. So, I'm 100% against it. I guess that was a long answer for something very short.
Well, it's an answer that matters to me, but I won't go into why I have another question. I'm going to skip one here because this other one follows the topic we're already on, from Jim in Arizona. Uh-huh. Cindy, do you think Obama is sincere about a peaceful solution with Syria?
I think that it's just my observation, and somebody who really studies these issues very hard, as somebody who knows the way the empire is. I've never been an Obama supporter, never voted for him one time. I'm very proud of that fact, but I think he was forced into a corner by the international community, especially Vladimir Putin of Russia. And they were forced into this so-called diplomatic solution, which I think is just a stalling strategy. And I think that the prize for the empire and for Israel is to totally destabilize Iran. And Syria is the door into Iran. So, no, I don't think Obama is really sincere about many things. But I think that he was just put in a position that he couldn't do anything else but what he has done.
Now, you've already mentioned that you're familiar with PNAC, but I want to take you to a question of my own, because one of the things that seemed to be the agenda is to remove the chemical weapons from Syria. Now, Israel is already occupying the Golan Heights, and I would guess the only reason they haven't gone full-on into Syria is the threat of chemical weapons. I have some concerns that once those weapons are out of there, that would be the next step for Israel to have free hand.
That's a concern for sure, and nobody is really sure of where the weapons came from and who actually used them. So there's a lot of evidence that the so-called rebels used the chemical weapons on the day where so many people were killed. So, you know, Israel not only it gets those billions of dollars from us every year, they have, somebody estimated, like 200 nuclear weapons. And so, to me, I'm against all nukes. I think all nukes should be disarmed. I think the nuclear power plant should be decommissioned. I think that, you know, the nuclear bomb should be disarmed. But the surrounding countries, I think, are just trying to defend themselves. And so Israel can go into any country with some massive firepower. I think the only thing that stops it is most of the rest of the world condemns those actions. There's been many times when the world wanted to condemn something that Israel did or stop Israel from doing something, and the United States has blocked that in the Security Council. So, you know, I think that the other nations arm themselves out of self-defense, out of, you know, we've seen that the United States only attacks weak countries. And so, to me, it's a natural response to two entities that are so violent and so militaristic, and that would be the U.S. Empire and Israel.
Okay, now you informed me shortly before the show started that you were going to be running on short time, so we've got about a minute or so left before you said you'd have to go.
Yeah.
Is there any final thoughts you want to share with our audience tonight?
Well, I just want people to go to cindy2014.org for my gubernatorial campaign, and you don't have to be in California. We have things that people can volunteer for outside of California, but also people can donate to the campaign, but no foreign donations, just people who actually live in the United States. And another thing is I have my own podcast and blog. It's at cindysheehanssoapbox.com. So people can get more information about my activism there and my radio show. And then the governor run is at cindy2014.org.
Okay, well, Cindy, I do want to thank you for being with us tonight.
Thanks for inviting me.
We're more than happy to have you. We appreciate your time, and there's many out here who feel like you do, but you give us voice, and we thank you.
Well, thank you.
Are we still here?
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the stable by the relief office as summer people, and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and